redistribution, and property rights. Apparently, patterned principles allow people to choose to expand upon themselves, but not upon others, those resources they are entitled to or rather receive under some favored distributional pattern, D-1. For if each of several persons chooses to expend some of his D-1 resources upon one other person, then that other person will receive more than his D-1 share, disturbing the favored distributional pattern. Maintaining a distributional pattern is individualism with a vengeance. Patterned distributional principles do not give people what entitlement principles do, only better distributed. For they do not give the right to choose what to do with what one has. They do not give the right to choose to pursue an end involving, intrinsically or as a means, the enhancement of another's position. To such views, families are disturbing, for within a family occur transfers that upset the favored distributional pattern. Either families themselves become units to which distribution takes place, the column occupiers, on what rationale, or loving behavior is forbidden. We should note in passing the ambivalent position of radicals toward the family. Its loving relationships are seen as a model to be emulated and extended across the whole society, at the same time that it is denounced as a suffocating institution to be broken and condemned as a focus of parochial concerns that interfere with achieving radical goals. Need we say that it is not appropriate to enforce across the wider society the relationships of love and care appropriate within a family, relationships which are voluntarily undertaken? One indication of the stringency of Rawls' difference principle, which we attend to in the second part of this chapter, is its inappropriateness as a governing principle even within a family of individuals who love one another. Should a family devote its resources to maximizing the position of its least well-off and least talented child, holding back the other children or using resources for their education and development only if they will follow a policy through their lifetimes of maximizing the position of their least fortunate sibling? Surely not. How then can this even be considered as the appropriate policy for enforcement in the wider society? I discuss later what I think would be Rawls' reply, that some principles apply at the macro level which do not apply to micro situations. Incidentally, love is an interesting instance of another relationship that is historical, in that, like justice, it depends upon what actually occurred. An adult may come to love another because of the other's characteristics, but it is the other person, and not the characteristics, that is loved. The love is not transferable to someone else with the same characteristics, even to one who scores higher for these characteristics. And the love endures through changes of the characteristics that gave rise to it. One loves the particular person one actually encountered. Why love is historical, attaching to persons in this way and not to characteristics, is an interesting and puzzling question. Proponents of patterned principles of distributive justice focus upon criteria for determining who is to receive holdings. They consider the reasons for which someone should have something, and also the total picture of holdings. Whether or not it is better to give than to receive, proponents of patterned principles ignore giving altogether. In considering the distribution of goods, income, and so forth, their theories are theories of recipient justice. They completely ignore any right a person might have to give something to someone. Even in exchanges where each party is simultaneously giver and recipient, patterned principles of justice focus only upon the recipient role and its supposed rights. Thus, discussions tend to focus on whether people should have a right to inherit, rather than on whether people should have a right to bequeath, or on whether persons who have a right to hold also have a right to choose that others hold in their place. I lack a good explanation of why the usual theories of distributive justice are so recipient-oriented. Ignoring givers and transferers and their rights is of a piece with ignoring producers and their entitlements, but why is it all ignored? Patterned principles of distributive justice necessitate redistributive activities. The likelihood is small that any actual freely arrived at set of holdings fits a given pattern, and the likelihood is nil that it will continue to fit the pattern as people exchange and give. From the point of view of an entitlement theory, redistribution is a serious matter indeed, involving, as it does, the violation of people's rights. An exception is those takings that fall under the principle of the rectification of injustices. From other points of view, also, it is serious. Taxation of earnings from labor is on a par with forced labor. Some persons find this claim obviously true. Taking the earnings of N hours labor is like taking N hours from the person. It is like forcing the person to work N hours for another's purpose. Others find the claim absurd, but even these, if they object to forced labor, would oppose forcing unemployed hippies to work for the benefit of the needy, and they would also object to forcing each person to work 5 extra hours each week for the benefit of the needy. But a system that takes 5 hours' wages in taxes does not seem to them like one that forces someone to work 5 hours, since it offers the person forced a wider range of choice in activities than does taxation in kind with the particular labor specified. But we can imagine a gradation of systems of forced labor from one that specifies a particular activity to one that gives a choice among two activities to, and so on up. Furthermore, people envisage a system with something like a proportional tax on everything above the amount necessary for basic needs. Some think this does not force someone to work extra hours, since there is no fixed number of extra hours he is forced to work, and since he can avoid the tax entirely by earning only enough to cover his basic needs. This is a very uncharacteristic view of forcing for those who also think people are forced to do something whenever the alternatives they face are considerably worse. However, neither view is correct. The fact that others intentionally intervene in violation of a side constraint against aggression to threaten force to limit the alternatives, in this case to paying taxes, or presumably the worse alternative, bare subsistence, makes the taxation system one of forced labor and distinguishes it from other cases of limited choices, which are not forcings. I am unsure as to whether the arguments I'll present show that such taxation merely is forced labor, so that is on a par with means is one kind of, or alternatively, whether the arguments emphasize the great similarities between such taxation and forced labor, to show it is plausible and illuminating to view such taxation in the light of forced labor. This latter approach would remind one of how John Wisdom conceives of the claims of metaphysicians. Nothing hangs on the fact that here and elsewhere I speak loosely of needs, since I go on each time to reject the criterion of justice which includes it. If, however, something did depend upon the notion, one would want to examine it more carefully. For a skeptical view, see Kenneth Minogue, The Liberal Mind, New York, Random House, 1963, pages 103 to 112. The man who chooses to work longer to gain an income more than sufficient for his basic needs prefers some extra goods or services to the leisure and activities he could perform during the possible non-working hours, whereas the man who chooses not to work the extra time prefers the leisure activities to the extra goods or services he could acquire by working more. Given this, if it would be illegitimate for a tax system to seize some of a man's leisure, forced labor, for the purpose of serving the needy, how can it be legitimate for a tax system to seize some of a man's goods for that purpose? Why should we treat the man whose happiness requires certain material goods or services differently from the man whose preferences and desires make such goods unnecessary for his happiness? Why should the man who prefers seeing a movie, and who has to earn money for a ticket, be open to the required call to aid the needy, while the person who prefers looking at a sunset, and hence need earn no extra money, is not? Indeed, isn't it surprising that redistributionists choose to ignore the man whose pleasures are so easily attainable without extra labor, while adding yet another burden to the poor unfortunate who must work for his pleasures? If anything, one would have expected the reverse. Why is the person with the non-material or non-consumption desire allowed to proceed unimpeded to his most favored feasible alternative, whereas the man whose pleasures or desires involve material things and who must work for extra money, thereby serving whomever considers his activities valuable enough to pay him, is constrained in what he can realize? Perhaps there is no difference in principle, and perhaps some think the answer concerns merely administrative convenience. These questions and issues will not disturb those who think that forced labor to serve the needy or to realize some favored end-state pattern is acceptable. In a fuller discussion, we would have and want to extend our argument to include interest, entrepreneurial profits, and so on. Those who doubt that this extension can be carried through, and who draw the line here at taxation of income from labor, will have to state rather complicated patterned historical principles of distributive justice, since end-state principles would not distinguish sources of income in any way. It is enough for now to get away from end-state principles and to make clear how various patterned principles are dependent upon particular views about the sources or the illegitimacy or lesser legitimacy of profits, interest, and so on, which particular views may well be mistaken. What sort of right over others does a legally institutionalized end-state pattern give one? The central core of the notion of a property right in X, relative to which other parts of the notion are to be explained, is the right to determine what shall be done with X, the right to choose which of the constrained set of options concerning X shall be realized or attempted. The constraints are set by other principles or laws operating in the society, in our theory by the Lockean rights people possess under the minimal state. My property rights in my knife allow me to leave it where I will, but not in your chest. I may choose which of the acceptable options involving the knife is to be realized. This notion of property helps us to understand why earlier theorists spoke of people as having property in themselves and their labor. They viewed each person as having a right to decide what would become of himself and what he would do, and as having a right to reap the benefits of what he did. This right of selecting the alternative to be realized from the constrained set of alternatives may be held by an individual or by a group, with some procedure for reaching a joint decision, or the right may be passed back and forth, so that one year I decide what's to become of X, and the next year you do, with the alternative of destruction perhaps being excluded. Or during the same time period, some types of decisions about X may be made by me and others by you, and so on. We lack an adequate, fruitful, analytical apparatus for classifying the types of constraints on the set of options among which choices are to be made, and the types of ways decision powers can be held, divided, and amalgamated. A theory of property would, among other things, contain such a classification of constraints and decision modes, and from a small number of principles would follow a host of interesting statements about the consequences and effects of certain combinations of constraints and modes of decision. When end-result principles of distributive justice are built into the legal structure of a society, they, as do most patterned principles, give each citizen an enforceable claim to some portion of the total social product, that is, to some portion of the sum total of the individually and jointly made products. This total product is produced by individuals laboring, using means of production others have saved to bring into existence, by people organizing production or creating means to produce new things or things in a new way. It is on this batch of individual activities that patterned distributional principles give each individual an enforceable claim. Each person has a claim to the activities and the products of other persons, independently of whether the other persons enter into particular relationships that give rise to these claims, and independently of whether they voluntarily take these claims upon themselves, in charity or in exchange for something. Whether it is done through taxation on wages or on wages over a certain amount, or through seizure of profits, or through there being a big social pot so that it's not clear what's coming from where and what's going where, patterned principles of distributive justice involve appropriating the actions of other persons. Seizing the results of someone's labor is equivalent to seizing hours from him and directing him to carry on various activities. If people force you to do certain work or unrewarded work for a certain period of time, they decide what you are to do and what purposes your work is to serve, apart from your decisions. This process whereby they take this decision from you makes them a part owner of you. It gives them a property right in you. Just as having such partial control and power of decision by right over an animal or inanimate object would be to have a property right in it. End state and most patterned principles of distributive justice institute partial ownership by others of people and their actions and labor. These principles involve a shift from the classical liberals' notion of self-ownership to a notion of partial property rights in other people. Considerations such as these confront end state and other patterned conceptions of justice with the question of whether the actions necessary to achieve the selected pattern don't themselves violate moral side constraints. Any view holding that there are moral side constraints on actions, that not all moral considerations can be built into end states that are to be achieved, refer to Chapter 3, must face the possibility that some of its goals are not achievable by any morally permissible available means. An entitlement theorist will face such conflicts in a society that deviates from the principles of justice for the generation of holdings, if and only if the only actions available to realize the principles themselves violate some moral constraints. Since deviation from the first two principles of justice, in acquisition and transfer, will involve other persons' direct and aggressive intervention to violate rights, and since moral constraints will not exclude defensive or retributive action in such cases, the entitlement theorist's problem rarely will be pressing. And whatever difficulties he has in applying the principle of rectification to persons who did not themselves violate the first two principles, are difficulties in balancing the conflicting considerations so as correctly to formulate the complex principle of rectification itself, he will not violate moral side constraints by applying the principle. Proponents of patterned conceptions of justice, however, often will face head-on clashes, and poignant ones if they cherish each party to the clash, between moral side constraints on how individuals may be treated and their patterned conception of justice that presents an end state or other pattern that must be realized. May a person emigrate from a nation that has institutionalized some end state or pattern distributional principle? For some principles, for example, Hayek's emigration presents no theoretical problem, but for others it is a tricky matter. Consider a nation having a compulsory scheme of minimal social provision to aid the neediest, or one organized so as to maximize the position of the worst-off group. No one may opt out of participating in it. None may say, "Don't compel me to contribute to others and don't provide for me via this compulsory mechanism if I am in need." Everyone above a certain level is forced to contribute to aid the needy. But if emigration from the country were allowed, anyone could choose to move to another country that did not have compulsory social provision, but otherwise was, as much as possible, identical. In such a case, the person's only motive for leaving would be to avoid participating in the compulsory scheme of social provision. And if he does leave, the needy in his initial country will receive no compelled help from him. What rationale yields the result that the person be permitted to emigrate, yet forbidden to stay and opt out of the compulsory scheme of social provision? If providing for the needy is of overriding importance, this does militate against allowing internal opting out, but it also speaks against allowing external emigration. Would it also support, to some extent, the kidnapping of persons living in a place without compulsory social provision who could be forced to make a contribution to the needy in your community? Perhaps the crucial component of the position that allows emigration solely to avoid certain arrangements, while not allowing anyone internally to opt out of them, is a concern for fraternal feelings within the country. We don't want anyone here who doesn't contribute, who doesn't care enough about the others to contribute. That concern, in this case, would have to be tied to the view that forced aiding tends to produce fraternal feelings between the aided and the aider, or perhaps merely to the view that the knowledge that someone or other voluntarily is not aiding produces unfraternal feelings. Locke's theory of acquisition. Before we turn to consider other theories of justice in detail, we must introduce an additional bit of complexity into the structure of the entitlement theory. This is best approached by considering Locke's attempt to specify a principle of justice in acquisition. Locke views property rights in an unowned object as originating through someone's mixing his labor with it. This gives rise to many questions. What are the boundaries of what labor is mixed with? If a private astronaut clears a place on Mars, Has he mixed his labor with, so that he comes to own the whole planet, the whole uninhabited universe, or just a particular plot? Which plot does an act bring under ownership? The minimal, possibly disconnected area, such that an act decreases entropy in that area and not elsewhere? Can virgin land, for the purposes of ecological investigation by high-flying airplane, come under ownership by a Lockean process? Building a fence around a territory presumably would make one the owner of only the fence and the land immediately underneath it. Why does mixing one's labor with something make one the owner of it? Perhaps because one owns one's labor, and so one comes to own a previously unowned thing that becomes permeated with what one owns. Ownership seeps over into the rest. But why isn't mixing what I own with what I don't own a way of losing what I own rather than a way of gaining what I don't? If I own a can of tomato juice and spill it in the sea so that its molecules, made radioactive so I can check this, mingle evenly throughout the sea, do I thereby come to own the sea, or have I foolishly dissipated my tomato juice? Perhaps the idea, instead, is that laboring on something improves it and makes it more valuable, and anyone is entitled to own a thing whose value he has created. Reinforcing this, perhaps, is the view that laboring is unpleasant. If some people made things effortlessly, as the cartoon characters in the yellow submarine trail flowers in their wake, would they have lesser claim to their own products, whose making didn't cost them anything? Ignore the fact that laboring on something may make it less valuable, spraying pink enamel paint on a piece of driftwood that you have found. Why should one's entitlement extend to the whole object rather than to just the added value one's labor has produced? Such reference to value might also serve to delimit the extent of ownership. For example, substitute increases the value of for decreases entropy in the earlier entropy criterion. No workable or coherent value-added property scheme has yet been devised, and any such scheme presumably would fall to objections similar to those that fell the theory of Henry George. It will be implausible to view improving an object as giving full ownership to it if the stock of unowned objects that might be improved is limited. For an object coming under one person's ownership changes the situation of all others. Whereas previously they were at liberty, in Hofeld's sense, to use the object, they now no longer are. This change in the situation of others by removing their liberty to act on a previously unowned object need not worsen their situation. If I appropriate a grain of sand from Coney Island, no one else may now do as they will with that grain of sand, but there are plenty of other grains of sand left for them to do the same with. Or, if not grains of sand, then other things. Alternatively, the things I do with the grain of sand I appropriate might improve the position of others, counterbalancing their loss of the liberty to use that grain. The crucial point is whether appropriation of an unowned object worsens the situation of others. Locke's proviso that there be enough and as good left in common for others, section 27, is meant to ensure that the situation of others is not worsened. If this proviso is met, is there any motivation for his further condition of non-waste? It is often said that this proviso once held but now no longer does, but there appears to be an argument for the conclusion that if the proviso no longer holds, then it cannot ever have held so as to yield permanent and inheritable property rights. Consider the first person, Z, for whom there is not enough and is good left to appropriate. The last person, Y, to appropriate left Z without his previous liberty to act on an object, and so worsened Z's situation. So Y's appropriation is not allowed under Locke's proviso. Therefore, the next to last person, X, to appropriate left Y in a worse position, for X's act ended permissible appropriation. Therefore, X's appropriation wasn't permissible. But then the appropriator 2 from last, W, ended permissible appropriation. And so, since it worsened X's position, W's appropriation wasn't permissible. And so on back to the first person, A, to appropriate a permanent property right. This argument, however, proceeds too quickly. Someone may be made worse off by another's appropriation in two ways. First, by losing the opportunity to improve his situation by a particular appropriation or anyone, and second, by no longer being able to use freely, without appropriation, what he previously could. A stringent requirement that another not be made worse off by an appropriation would exclude the first way, if nothing else counterbalances the diminution in opportunity, as well as the second. A weaker requirement would exclude the second way, though not the first. With the weaker requirement, we cannot zip back so quickly from Z to A, as in the earlier argument. For though person Z can no longer appropriate, there may remain some for him to use, as before. In this case, wise appropriation would not violate the weaker Lockean condition. With less remaining that people are at liberty to use, users might face more inconvenience, crowding, and so on. In that way, the situation of others might be worsened, unless appropriation stopped far short of such a point. It is arguable that no one legitimately can complain if the weaker provision is satisfied. However, since this is less clear than in the case of the more stringent proviso, Locke may have intended this stringent proviso by enough and as good remaining, and perhaps he meant the non-waste condition to delay the end point from which the argument zips back. Is the situation of persons who are unable to appropriate, there being no more accessible and useful unowned objects, worsened by a system allowing appropriation and permanent property? Here enter the various familiar social considerations favoring private property. It increases the social product by putting means of production in the hands of those who can use them most efficiently, profitably. Experimentation is encouraged, because with separate persons controlling resources, there is no one person or small group whom someone with a new idea must convince to try it out. Private property enables people to decide on the pattern and types of risks they wish to bear, leading to specialized types of risk-bearing. Private property protects future persons by leading some to hold back resources from current consumption for future markets. It provides alternate sources of employment for unpopular persons who don't have to convince any one person or small group to hire them, and so on. These considerations enter a Lockean theory to support the claim that appropriation of private property satisfies the intent behind the enough and is good left over proviso, not as a utilitarian justification of property. They enter to rebut the claim that because the proviso is violated, no natural right to private property can arise by a Lockean process. The difficulty in working such an argument to show that the proviso is satisfied is in fixing the appropriate baseline for comparison. Lockean appropriation makes people no worse off than they would be. How? This question of fixing the baseline needs more detailed investigation than we are able to give it here. It would be desirable to have an estimate of the general economic importance of original appropriation in order to see how much leeway there is for differing theories of appropriation and the location of the baseline. Perhaps this importance can be measured by the percentage of all income that is based upon untransformed raw materials and given resources, rather than upon human actions, mainly rental income representing the unimproved value of land and the price of raw material in situ, and by the percentage of current wealth which represents such income in the past. I have not seen a precise estimate. David Friedman, The Machinery of Freedom, New York, Harper & Row, 1973, pages Roman 14 and 15, discusses this issue and suggests 5% of U.S. national income is an upper limit for the first two factors mentioned. However, he does not attempt to estimate the percentage of current wealth which is based upon such income in the past. The vague notion of based upon merely indicates a topic needing investigation. We should note that it is not only persons favoring private property who need a theory of how property rights legitimately originate. Those believing in collective property, for example, those believing that a group of persons living in an area jointly own the territory or its mineral resources, also must provide a theory of how such property rights arise. They must show why the persons living there have rights to determine what is done with the land and resources there, that persons living elsewhere don't have with regard to the same land and resources. The proviso. Whether or not Locke's particular theory of appropriation can be spelled out so as to handle various difficulties, I assume that any adequate theory of justice in acquisition will contain a proviso similar to the weaker of the ones we have attributed to Locke. A process normally giving rise to a permanent bequeathable property right in a previously unowned thing will not do so if the position of others no longer at liberty to use the thing is thereby worsened. It is important to specify this particular mode of worsening the situation of others, for the proviso does not encompass other modes. It does not include the worsening due to more limited opportunities to appropriate, the first way mentioned earlier, corresponding to the more stringent condition, and it does not include how I worsen a seller's position if I appropriate materials to make some of what he is selling and then enter into competition with him. Someone whose appropriation otherwise would violate the proviso still may appropriate, provided he compensates the others so that their situation is not thereby worsened. Unless he does compensate these others, his appropriation will violate the proviso of the principle of justice in acquisition and will be an illegitimate one. Fourier held that since the process of civilization had deprived the members of society of certain liberties, to gather, pasture, engage in the chase, a socially guaranteed minimum provision for persons was justified as compensation for the loss. Alexander Gray, The Socialist Tradition, New York, Harper and Row, 1968, page 188. But this puts the point too strongly. This compensation would be due those persons, if any, for whom the process of civilization was a net loss, for whom the benefits of civilization did not counterbalance being deprived of these particular liberties. A theory of appropriation incorporating this Lockean proviso will handle correctly the cases, objections to the theory lacking the proviso, where someone appropriates the total supply of something necessary for life. For example, Rashdall's case of someone who comes upon the only water in the desert several miles ahead of others who will also come to it and appropriates it all. Hastings Rashdall, The Philosophical Theory of Property, in Property, Its Duties and Rights, London, Macmillan, 1915. We should note Ayn Rand's theory of property rights, Man's Rights in the Virtue of Selfishness, New York, New American Liberty, 1964, page 94, wherein these follow from the right to life, since people need physical things to live. But a right to life is not a right to whatever one needs to live. Other people may have rights over these other things. Refer to Chapter 3 of this audiobook. At most, a right to life would be a right to have or strive for whatever one needs to live, provided that having it does not violate anyone else's rights. With regard to material things, the question is whether having it does violate any right of others. Would appropriation of all unowned things do so? Would appropriating the waterhole in Rashdall's example? Since special considerations, such as the Lockean proviso, may enter with regard to material property, one first needs a theory of property rights before one can apply any supposed right to life, as amended earlier. Therefore, the right to life cannot provide the foundation for a theory of property rights. A theory which includes this proviso in its principle of justice in acquisition must also contain a more complex principle of justice in transfer. Some reflection of the proviso about appropriation constrains later actions. If my appropriating all of a certain substance violates the Lockean proviso, then so does my appropriating some and purchasing all the rest from others who obtained it without otherwise violating the Lockean proviso. If the proviso excludes someone's appropriating all the drinkable water in the world, it also excludes his purchasing it all. More weakly and messily, it may exclude his charging certain prices for some of his supply. This proviso, almost, never will come into effect. The more someone acquires of a scarce substance which others want, the higher the price of the rest will go, and the more difficult it will become for him to acquire it all. But still, we can imagine, at least, that something like this occurs. Someone makes simultaneous secret bids to the separate owners of a substance, each of whom sells, assuming he can easily purchase more from the other owners, or some natural catastrophe destroys all of the supply of something except that in one person's possession. The total supply could not be permissibly appropriated by one person at the beginning. His later acquisition of it all does not show that the original appropriation violated the proviso, even by a reverse argument similar to the one made earlier that tried to zip back from Z to A. Rather, it is the combination of the original appropriation plus all the later transfers and actions that violates the Lockean proviso. Each owner's title to his holding includes the historical shadow of the Lockean proviso on appropriation. This excludes his transferring it into an agglomeration that does violate the Lockean proviso, and excludes his using it in a way in coordination with others or independently of them, so as to violate the proviso by making the situation of others worse than their baseline situation. Once it is known that someone's ownership runs afoul of the Lockean proviso, there are stringent limits on what he may do with, what is difficult any longer unreservedly to call, his property. Thus, a person may not appropriate the only water hole in a desert and charge what he will. Nor may he charge what he will if he possesses one, and unfortunately it happens that all the water holes in the desert dry up except for his. This unfortunate circumstance, admittedly no fault of his, brings into operation the Lockean proviso and limits his property rights. The situation would be different if his water hole didn't dry up, due to special precautions he took to prevent this. Compare our discussion of the case in the text with Hayek, The Constitution of Liberty, page 136, and also with Ronald Hamowy, Hayek's Concept of Freedom, A Critique, New Individualist Review, April 1961, pages 28 to 31. Similarly, an owner's property right in the only island in an area does not allow him to order a castaway from a shipwreck off his island as a trespasser, for this would violate the Lockean proviso. Notice that the theory does not say that owners do have these rights, but that the rights are overridden to avoid some catastrophe. Overridden rights do not disappear, they leave a trace of a sort absent in the cases under discussion. There is no such external and ad hoc overriding. Considerations internal to the theory of property itself, to its theory of acquisition and appropriation, provide the means for handling such cases. The results, however, may be coextensive with some condition about catastrophe, since the baseline for comparison is so low as compared to the productiveness of a society with private appropriation, that the question of the Lockean proviso being violated arises only in the case of catastrophe or a desert island situation. The fact that someone owns the total supply of something necessary for others to stay alive does not entail that his or anyone's appropriation of anything left some people, immediately or later, in a situation worse than the baseline one. A medical researcher who synthesizes a new substance that effectively treats a certain disease and who refuses to sell except on his terms does not worsen the situation of others by depriving them of whatever he has appropriated. The others easily can possess the same materials he appropriated. The researcher's appropriation or purchase of chemicals didn't make those chemicals scarce in a way so as to violate the Lockean proviso. Nor would someone else's purchasing the total supply of the synthesized substance from the medical researcher. The fact that the medical researcher uses easily available chemicals to synthesize the drug no more violates the Lockean proviso than does the fact that the only surgeon able to perform a particular operation eats easily obtainable food in order to stay alive and to have the energy to work. This shows that the Lockean proviso is not an end-state principle. It focuses on a particular way that appropriative actions affect others, and not on the structure of the situation that results. Intermediate between someone who takes all of the public supply and someone who makes the total supply out of easily obtainable substances is someone who appropriates the total supply of something in a way that does not deprive the others of it. For example, someone finds a new substance in an out-of-the-way place. He discovers that it effectively treats a certain disease and appropriates the total supply. He does not worsen the situation of others. If he did not stumble upon the substance, no one else would have, and the others would remain without it. However, as time passes, the likelihood increases that others would have come across the substance. Upon this fact might be based a limit to his property right in the substance, so that others are not below their baseline position. For example, its bequest might be limited. The theme of someone worsening another's situation by depriving him of something he otherwise would possess may also illuminate the example of patents. An inventor's patent does not deprive others of an object which would not exist if not for the inventor. Yet patents would have this effect on others who independently invent the object. Therefore, these independent inventors, upon whom the burden of proving independent discovery may rest, should not be excluded from utilizing their own invention as they wish, including selling it to others. Furthermore, a known inventor drastically lessens the chances of actual independent invention, for persons who know of an invention usually will not try to reinvent it, and the notion of independent discovery here would be murky at best. Yet we may assume that in the absence of the original invention, sometime later someone else would have come up with it. This suggests placing a time limit on patents as a rough rule of thumb to approximate how long it would have taken, in the absence of knowledge of the invention, for independent discovery. I believe that the free operation of a market system will not actually run afoul of the Lockean proviso. Recall that crucial to our story in Part 1 of how a protective agency becomes dominant and a de facto monopoly is the fact that it wields force in situations of conflict and is not merely in competition with other agencies. A similar tale cannot be told about other businesses. If this is correct, the proviso will not play a very important role in the activities of protective agencies and will not provide a significant opportunity for future state action. Indeed, were it not for the effects of previous illegitimate state action, people would not think the possibility of the proviso's being violated as of more interest than any other logical possibility. Here I make an empirical, historical claim, as does someone who disagrees with this. This completes our indication of the complication in the entitlement theory introduced by the Lockean proviso.